The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I am Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by a prolific author of fiction and non-fiction alike. A former rugby player, he has been shortlisted for the Goldsmiths Prize, a finalist for the Rathbones Folio Prize and winner of the Ackerley Prize for a literary biography of excellence. His fiction works, Lazarus is Dead and Acts of the Assassins, accrued widespread acclaim, and his latest book, Sad Little Men, is an uncompromising critique of English boarding schools. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Richard Beard.
Thank you, Dan. Lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you, because apart from anything else, as we're about to discover, you have written my favourite book. Well, I've already mentioned it, Acts of the Assassins, and I'm going to demand that you tell me more about it and how you came to write it, but that's not what we do right at the top of the show. Right at the beginning, because we're called Inspired Minds, I ask you about inspiration, and you have written so many different types of book. You've written memoirs, you've written some pretty esoteric stuff, but you know, you've also, as we mentioned in the opener, been a rugby player. Inspiration, has that been important to you in the writing of the books you've made or the paths that you've chosen in your life? And if so, what is it? What does inspiration look like to you?
I think it's very interesting to put those two things together, the sport and the writing, because I find it quite a difficult question of what inspires me to write. So I go to the sport first. I think playing sport, whether it's cricket or rugby, the two sports that I've played most, it is inspiring to think that one day everything can come right. In rugby, there's a moment where when you play in the backs, you see a gap, you make a break for a dummy or a sidestep. And from having these huge people lined up in front of you who want to hurt you quite badly, in the next instant, the whole green field opens up. There's nothing but open space and a sense of liberty. And it's a moment of perfection. And that's very inspiring. And you only need to have felt that once to think, yeah, I want some more of that. There's a kind of addiction. And I think quite a lot of inspiration is probably appealing to addictive personalities. You've done one thing once and you think, yeah, I want to do that again. That was great. That was a high. I also quite like the fact that the heroes I had when I was younger, still staying on the sporting theme at the moment, Gareth Edwards, for example, John Edrich, people who I used to love watching on the TV. We didn't really go to live sport at all. See them on the TV, and they seem to have a control of their very limited environment. The great thing about sport is you go over the white line, and then you are in a different world. And they had complete control over that world for a certain period of time. In Gareth Edwards' case, for years and years, he controlled the environment of the international rugby field. And I think that's very tempting when you feel that life is often out of control and chaotic. And it is, again, inspiring to think that, well, if in that small area of human endeavor, you can control life to this extent, to Gareth Edwards's extent, then perhaps I can do that too in life generally. That's something to aspire to. It's inspiring. I think that gets complicated with writing if the writer aspires, as I did at the beginning when I started off writing, to a modernist creed where the creed is to make it new. Because if you want to make it new, which is one of the reasons why I've written lots of different types of books, it's quite important not to be over-inspired by any one person or any one school. It's almost as if no one came before you. No one could predict what you were about to write. And clearly, that's not actually how it works. You're influenced by everything that has come through you. I'm sort of thinking inspiration and influence are almost synonyms here. But at the forefront of the mind is to do something original, do something new. Is that the same in sport? I think it's different in sport because certainly at the level I've been playing, I wasn't trying to do anything new. I was just trying to do the same thing as they do on the TV. And I would have been happy with that. Obviously, if you are at that level, then you can aspire to do something new. And maybe in writing, it's a sign that I have some confidence in what I'm doing, that I do feel that I can try to do new things, you know, in the various books that I've written.
There are a lot of things in there that I want to unpick, but I think they might actually come out over the course of our conversation, because in your writing, I don't want to start at the beginning. I want to start, I mean, when I say the end, I mean the most recent. I've read Sad Little Men very recently, and I've read a number of reviews of it, and it's caused a bit of consternation among certain people, an absolute joy and gladness in the heart of others, myself included, in reading it, because for listeners who are unaware, this is a book about your experiences of being at a public boarding school, both a preparatory school and later on when you go to Radley, and the characteristics that are kind of forced into you by that experience and by that structure. And those public schools have a lot of things in common. Radley has a lot in common with Eton, which will have a lot in common with Harrow and Charterhouse and so forth. And I'm fascinated that, in a way, it feels to me like your earlier writing is quite a long way away from this, because this is intensely personal. Sad Little Men is an intensely personal book, isn't it? As well as The Day That Went Missing. You know, these are books in which you really get inside you and you bring yourself out. Whereas it feels to me like your earlier writing, there's almost a sort of distance between you and the subject matter. So do you recognize that in yourself? Because I'm thinking within Sad Little Men, there's a very strong part that comes out to me, which is about game playing and not wanting to be ridiculed and not wanting to be laughed at and having these as defense mechanisms. And in a way, when you actually write Sad Little Men, you're really exposing yourself in a way that you would never have dared to do, it seems to me, when you were that child at school.
Well, I think that's a very perceptive way of looking at the different books, Dan, if I may say so. That itself is a defense, by the way, is to flatter you about your question. Very public school thing to do. There are a lot of the characteristics which come out of a private school education, particularly a boarding school education, are defensive, and they're about hiding and protecting the self because it is always open to attack or feels open to attack. And often is attacked, actually. That's why it becomes second nature to be defensive. A good example of that would be manners. You know, one of the things that people notice about the tribes that come out of boarding schools is they have excellent manners. Well, those manners are a deflecting mechanism. They're a way of saying, you can't get close to me because I know the right thing to do in almost every situation. And it means that you don't need to really reveal what you truly want or what you truly feel in any situation. And I think my early books, I was just reenacting this defensive mechanism. That's not to say I don't think there's some interesting stuff in there, because there clearly is. And my subconscious is always at work as well to get material out on the page. But there is still a sense that I'm putting forward the idea of a writer here. The first few books are experimental novels. There is something quite cerebral about them. They're saying there's no real writer here. There's a smart guy working out these problems on the page. But one of the problems I was genuinely working out at a subconscious level was, well, how do I get to a stage where I can write about, you know, the only thing I truly can know about in the world, which is myself, which I can be an authority on? And it's almost like I had to go through this process of chipping away at this defended self in writing. And with each book, there's a little more, got a little more frayed, got a little more raw, if you like, a bit more authentic, until I've ended up at this place where I find it hard to consider writing a straight novel now. Not that those original novels were particularly straight. They were, as I say, they were experimental, so they didn't read like straight narrative novels. But it means I've managed to arrive at a place eventually where I can write about that schooling and that education because I no longer feel enthralled to having to protect myself from it. And the writing has been an important part of that process.
What a lot of people have said about Sad Little Men, and I do sort of agree with it, it's an angry book. But I don't mean angry in the useless way, where anger can just be an entirely impotent emotion. It seems to me that it's properly angry. It seems like the culmination of your thinking these things through. Is that fair to say? I mean, you really do. How can I put this? You seem to be at one with the realization that it shouldn't have happened to you, that going to public boarding school should not have happened. And now finally you've been able to say that. Is that what part of this writing process has been about for you?
Well, I think there was an exasperation at the start of the writing process because it came about during COVID, watching the Prime Minister Boris Johnson stand at his lectern and flounder and harumph his way through those press conferences. And I was exasperated by the fact that I see Boris Johnson and I say, I know you. I've known people like you since my earliest schooling. You are almost a pure product of this system. And in fact, he started at boarding school in the same year as I did, and it's the same year as David Cameron did, 1975. So he would have been 11 when he started. Cameron was 8, as I would have been as well. And then the fact that I could recognize this, nobody else seemed to be able to see. Like, this isn't in any way sort of special or worth putting on the television or worth voting into number 10. This is a character type which is instantly recognizable to me. And I know what made him, because I went through the similar kind of education. And those schools at the time in the 70s, early 80s, I have no reason to believe it's any different now, were very similar. By design, they're supposed to produce the same types of people who can fulfill the same types of role, like a prime minister or judge or a senior barrister, management consultant. So they are all pretty similar. So you know that what you've lived through is going to be the same as other people who went through it at the same time. And so that, well, I said exasperation. Yeah, it was a kind of anger. I felt angry at knowing where these tics came from, where the Latin comes from, where the deflections come from, and thinking, come on, I mean, this is just, it should be able to see through this. So there was an anger there. But I think in terms of my own schooling, I was amazed by, from time to time, I would tell my children about things that happened to me when I was at school, and they would look at me with open eyes and their jaws on the floor and basically didn't believe me. I could see in their eyes, they'd go, oh, that's an exaggeration. That's just not true. And the more I thought about it, seeing their reactions, I thought, you know, the thing is, this is true. And this, I want to get this down on paper before it gets lost, because people won't believe this. And it's not only within our lifetime, it's actually a formative education for people in positions of power. And that's not just Cameron and Johnson, but through the media, in the military, in the church. And really, this country needs to know about the backgrounds of these people, because most people don't talk about it, because one of the other qualities which is ingrained is a kind of a murder where you don't talk about it. It's like sneaking. You shouldn't sneak about what happened. And I think there was always a bit of anger about that, going, well, okay, I'm going to sneak. That made me feel quite punchy because I needed to stand up for myself doing something which was transgressive in the terms of that education. But I don't think anger is the only emotion in there. I think that, you know, I am trying to understand how this happened and also what are the consequences for the people who went through it. And I think the major conclusion I came to is that the damage done to these small children set away from home is then passed on to others in later life, not necessarily in public life. It can be in private life as well.
Would it be safe to say that a sort of central part of the thesis is the trivialization of things that ought to be very important? I mean, there's something extraordinarily ironic about a school that is almost designed to produce prime ministers, but at the same time, it's designed for them not really to take anything particularly seriously. And you would sort of think that the running of a country would be the moment when you might actually take things terribly seriously. And yet the system bakes in people who are institutionalized to brush off anything, to trivialize absolutely anything, including running the country.
One of the things that we had in those what seem now far off days is, you know, before screens and everything, we had a film, I think every 2 weeks on a Saturday evening. And these films came on the reels inside their metal canisters. And one boy had the privilege of someone with a mechanical engineering mind would set it up, show these films. But they're a very limited number of films available, even in the mid-70s, to hire in this way. But one of the films was Waterloo. Have you seen Waterloo, Go?
Yes.
And there's a moment where someone is sitting next to Wellington on his horse and he has his leg blown off. And he says something like, I'm sorry, sir, I think I've just lost my leg. And then sort of keels over. And that's all he managed to say. And there's something that within the British mythology, we've always felt this is very valuable to have this sort of minimizing of drama. You know, drama is a terrible thing, but drama is often emotion. I mean, if something is serious, it is dramatic. And although that's one example of how that works culturally, if you then spread that into a whole worldview, then in fact, nothing is serious because it's just something else to minimize, not to cause trouble to others and to treat it with this sort of British sang-froid, to use not a British term.
Typically, of course, because that's where hypocrisy comes in. But when you said that, it just reminded me of a couple of obvious satires of that would have been around in the 70s and 80s. You've got Monty Python, the Holy Grail, the Black Knight, it's but a scratch. You've got actually The Meaning of Life, haven't you? I think there's a scene set in a military hospital where people are losing their legs left, right and center. And Carry On Up the Khyber, which is I didn't think when I started this I was going to reference Carry On Up the Khyber, but there's a scene there, isn't there, where they're all having tea and the place is being blown up and nothing can interrupt tiffin. But it seems to me that all this satire made absolutely no difference whatsoever to the amplification of this idea. It just continues. And however much we laugh at it, it doesn't seem to change. What I found especially beguiling about Sad Little Men is that you don't shy away from that. You don't trivialize it. You don't laugh at it. You actually say that it's the root cause of a whole load of things that are wrong with the country. And until they change, the country can't change, which is it was a very serious point to make, especially a serious point to make for someone who was brought up in an environment in which you're encouraged to take nothing seriously. Have you reached a point, do you think, where working through your past and your upbringing has allowed you to embrace actually being serious about these issues?
Well, the humour, in particular self-deprecating humour, is always acceptable in British discourse, desirable quality to have, but it's also very damaging. It's clearly deflective. I think I was always probably quite serious, but then in terms of inspirations, I would have wanted to be funny. I mean, if you think of those just blurbs on the back of books, and you can't become a writer without reading a lot of books, and you flip them over in the bookshop, and even this incredibly, what's clearly a bleak book, it will have, as the blurb writer tries to make you buy it while you're in the bookshop, it will say, but nevertheless, very funny at times, as if this is a quality which is going to take you into one of these bleak universes. So I don't think being serious about bad things means you can't value humor, but I do think taking things seriously is an important part of growing up. And one of the problems, if you get into a habit of diminishing things outside you through humor and things that happen to you through humor and other people through humor, it's another type of bullying, actually, to diminish other people through humor. If you never grow out of that, then you don't grow up, and then you can't make an adult contribution to society. Now, that becomes serious if that is true of people who are actually running our society.
Now, I want to just delve a little bit deeper into memoir, because you touched on memoir and how you think it's important. And you've written something for the Rathbones Review on memoir. And there's almost an industry now in which people can almost get their memoirs curated, ghostwritten, published, and not necessarily with a view to selling vast numbers of copies of it, not necessarily with a view to becoming rich at all, just to have committed one's memories to paper. Why do you think that is so important?
Well, I wrote in the piece that I think this is the direction of travel of all art, in fact, away from kings and queens and archbishops and the nobility, towards the idea that every life has value. And one way that can be expressed is through art. You know, well, in the last sort of, say, since about 1600 until probably this century, literature has been one of the best ways to tell those stories, the stories of all sorts of different people from different backgrounds. And so if you take that direction of travel to its logical conclusion, then everyone's life is equally valuable, which is not only responsible for the way that the content of literature has changed, but it's also something which is true of the way that society has changed as well. Then the idea that everyone, you know, it's worth spending your time writing down your life when you've come to a certain stage of life becomes, you know, really quite a sensible thing to do and a valid thing to do. And there are people who will help. Not everyone is naturally a writer. And I think, you know, that's more of a good thing than a bad thing. It's quite easy to be cynical sometimes and think, oh, well, this is just another industry which has started up, which will exploit people's vanity. But again, it's something about taking your own life seriously. I'm going to write down my life. Why shouldn't you take your own life seriously? Why is it, you know, a kind of vain, egotistical thing to do to write down what happened to you? It's as valid as what happened to anybody else, and particularly to you. I mean, you're the person who knows it best. You're the best person to write it down. So I'm all for it.
When you come to do that, though, and I'm thinking now about the day that went missing, that must have been an incredibly difficult bit of memoir to write. Because in the book, you describe a family situation in which the events on that day, which are probably best coming out of your mouth, are shuttered away. And, I mean, ignored is not going to be the right word, because all of you will have still been living with the experiences of it, but not shared amongst each other. And then you come to write it down yourself, and it becomes a book, and it's put out there. How difficult is that? Because your memoir is also obviously going to transact with other people's memories as well, isn't it?
So the book is about the day that my brother, who was 9 years old when I was 11, he drowned while we were on holiday in Cornwall. We went to the beach, sort of standard there at the beach. He drowned, and I was in the water with him when he drowned. And after that, the family closed round the memory, and really it was never spoken of again until I decided about 6 or 7 years ago now that I was just going to ask the rest of the family about their memories. Well, actually, it wasn't quite as simple as that. What happened was I wrote in a novel, Lazarus is Dead, where Lazarus is a friend of Jesus. In fact, in the Bible, Lazarus is Jesus's only named friend. So he has this privileged position in the Bible, and they are friends. And in this novel, they go swimming in Lake Galilee, and Lazarus's younger brother, who I invented for the purposes of the novel, drowns. And I wrote it exactly as I remembered being in the water with my brother when he drowned, but it's in a fiction. And I thought, well, this is, you know, my family are bound to pick up on this, and we're going to, you know, there was something in me which wanted to raise this issue and talk about it. But what I discovered from doing that was, first of all, not all my family read my books was the first thing that I discovered. So they knew nothing about it. But also those who did, in particular, my brother is a keen reader. I would say he's probably got the second largest collection of Richard Beard books in existence after me. He didn't comment on it at all. So I asked him about it. And he said, I didn't even know you were in the water with him. So this sort of very basic fact of my life had been for what wasn't even a pre. And then I asked my younger brother. And he said, no, I thought he was just washed off a rock. And so they've got a completely different idea. And I thought, well, this needs to be corrected. That's why the book is called The Day That Went Missing, because it's gone missing in our collective memory and it needs to be recovered in some way. And there were very obvious ways that had gone missing. I mean, I didn't know where the date was. I didn't know what month it was in. I couldn't remember the name of the beach or where it was. And therefore, that became a kind of investigation to find out about these things. So let's go back again to the original question there, which again was a good one.
I guess the question that comes to me there is that you're writing a memoir, but it's a memoir of your life, yes, but it's also a memoir of other people's lives. How did you navigate that? Because to call that a touchy subject would be something of a massive understatement, I would have thought. The death of a sibling and of a son within a family that's not been processed at all, and then you choose to write about it. How difficult is it to put your memories in there? Because obviously they're going to butt up against other people's as well.
Two things to say about that, really. First, my mum, I talked to my mum about it. I interviewed my own mum, which is a very interesting thing to do, is to sit down with a pad and a pen and interview your own mum and go through all the ruses that interviewers go through to get information out of her. But in fact, I didn't have to use those because it turned out she'd been dying for someone to ask her these questions for 30 years. She'd wanted someone to sit down and ask her, you know, how do you remember it? How was it? I mean, in terms of, you know, what actually happened, I mean, because I was there and I was in the water, I felt I had a position to of strength, if you like, to tell this story from. But also, I had a belief in facts of it. There were certain things which happened which were factual. And in order to piece together those facts, I was fortunate enough to be able to talk to one of the lifeboatmen who was on the RNLI boat, which was sent out from Port Isaac. And although he had been a long time retired from the lifeboats, he had an absolutely clear memory of that day and what had happened and what it was like to pull the body from the water. And again, that was a strange interview to do in the boathouse by the sea in Port Isaac, because he remembered this and was very emotional about it. And I kind of felt, as the facts came together, that sort of connects into one of the responsibilities of being a writer, is that I was saying, this is what happened. I've pieced it together. I trust my process. And then when I showed it to the family members who were involved beforehand, so my two brothers, my mum, I didn't ask them if they disagreed with any of my opinions or thoughts about it. I just asked them to say if they thought anything I'd written was untrue. And I think that's quite important in when you're writing a memoir, is if you're faithful to what happened and nothing in it is untrue, you're then perfectly within your rights to have your opinions and attitudes to whatever has happened in your life. It is a subjective piece of writing. You know, it's not an obituary. You're not writing your own obituary and saying, you know, this happened and then this happened and this happened. I'm trying to keep it as objective as possible to have an overview after a point where you're not going to do anything else, which is interesting. It's subjective, it's ongoing, and it should be full of life in that sense. The life of your inner life, which you are applying to these things that have happened to you. But at the same time, you do have a responsibility to make sure that the facts are correct as far as you can make them.
How did that affect your both relationship with and your understanding of your family? Because I imagine once you've gone through that process, suddenly, I suppose, well, not necessarily suddenly, this would have been something that you'd live with as being part of your family, but being aware that this event had been locked away, almost like the speed of moving on. Was there designed to almost protect the family, a little bit like the stiff upper lip we've been talking about earlier? Oh, it is but a scratch. Oh, I better go to the sand. My leg's been blown off. Don't worry, sir. You know, is that all part of the same sort of process that you found out about your family in the process of making this book? Or was it something that you were always very aware of?
Well, I found out things which I blocked out of my memory, clearly repressed. And one of the ones I found most shocking was, for some reason, we're having a 3-week holiday. Nikki's death came at the end of the first week. We went back to Swindon, which is where I grew up, there was the funeral. And then because the 3 weeks of the holiday were paid for, we all went back for the third week of the holiday, which I was shocked to discover. I'd completely blanked this out of my memory. And as I wrote in the book, I think my parents were deranged. You know, they were deranged by grief at the time. And their instinct was to do exactly what you said. You know, well, you've got to get back on the horse. You know, you've got to carry on with your life. But really to do that, you know, all within the space of 3 weeks does seem to me to be deranged. And I think there was a kind of madness which overcame them. But their place of refuge was this very English place of refuge, to say, no, nothing's happened. And in a way, not to take it seriously and not to try and stop the grief. I mean, it didn't work. And my mum is very clear about the fact that it didn't work. But that was the instinct that they had. And again, I mean, we live in a very strange country. You know, we have strange rituals. We have strange games. You know all about that. We have instincts which don't always work in our own best interest in the long run. But having said that, they're probably very useful if you're on the northwest frontier and under fire. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you see, that's got me thinking now about something that you said right at the very beginning about the inspiration and the inspiration of Gareth Edwards and John Edridge. For listeners who are unaware of these two characters, I couldn't really think of two more different sporting characters. One is full of flamboyance and flair, Gareth Edwards, the Welsh scrum half, and John Edridge is an epitome in cricket of obduracy. But the word you used there was control about them both. And in their own different ways, I completely understand why you would be inspired by both of them, because John Edridge is controlling the space around him through his obduracy, through his, you know, his immovability, I suppose. So when you were in school and you've got all those things that are kind of out of your control, and you detail them a great deal in Sad Little Men, you know, just the other boys, the probing for weakness, the being careful not to show too much enthusiasm for anything, having to control your own emotions for fear of them being exposed. Was sport a place where you could unashamedly take control rather than be controlled?
Yeah, I think in the most recent thing that I've written, I've written about sport in there, I think in particular rugby was also very useful because it was a space where you don't have to think, right? It really is like a full wash and rinse for the mind. You know, you go onto the pitch and you can think of nothing else apart from the fact that people are trying to jump on you and you're trying to avoid them, and you're fully involved in the physical effort and the physical ambitions you have on that pitch. You cannot think about anything else. And if you are a natural overthinker, which I am, it was a huge relief. And it's very important, I think, for my sanity and just general mental health to have that, you know, once a week and in a match, a couple of times a week in training for really, you know, many years, 15 years of senior rugby. That's one of the appeals of sport. But I think in terms of inspiration, I mean, there are some sort of influences you choose and some you don't choose. If you have a trauma in your childhood, clearly you don't choose that, but it will be an inspiration in the sense that it will be something which makes you want to either compensate or explain, you know, later in life if you're in one of the arts. And there are some that you choose. And I would choose, say, Edridge. But the reason why I was drawn to him was because of his sleeves. The sleeves on his long-sleeved cricket sweater were always absolutely perfectly square and rolled. And I found something incredibly pleasing about this. And that was enough to make him my guy. He had these, you know, he'd taken care to do his sleeves in this perfect way, which to a child was miraculous. You know, I knew there was no one in my life who did their sleeves like this. And I thought, he knows something about life. This is his secret charm somehow. Of course, you don't get that these days with everyone having sort of short polyester sleeves. It's not quite the same thing. But that is strange things like that. So, you know, and yes, there's an element of control there. He was clearly controlling his clothes, and that spoke to a larger the importance of control to him as a sports person. But then, as you say, you know, Gareth Edwards, very different. And he had a flair, this kind of this Welsh flair on the pitch, and could score from anywhere, see opportunities, understand the chaotic dynamics of rugby, just had an understanding of them. That's why I loved him. And I've been lucky enough to sit next to him at the rugby writers lunch recently, and he was such a wonderful, charming person to sit next to. And although I knew that he had told all his stories before and he had a lot of fantastic stories, I felt that if I had lunch with him the next day, he'd also tell me a lot of stories that he told me before, but they'd all be completely different stories. And I felt that could probably go on for weeks.
So when you've left university and you're still playing rugby, at what point do you recognize that you want to be a writer? Did you know that at school? Because that'd be something that you wouldn't probably let slip, I'm imagining, in Radley. I want to be a novelist. I imagine that's not necessarily, you know, going to endear you too much, or is it seems outre enough and cool enough to give you some kind of special status?
Well, I don't think I did know it at that point. I think I knew it and was inspired by student life, because along with my brother, we were the first generation of our family to go to university. It was something that I both very much wanted to happen and very much valued, because I think partly because my dad valued it so much because he regretted not having had that opportunity himself. And then when I did arrive at university and was a student, I just loved the lifestyle. And I thought, you know, this is how I want to get up late, read books, you know, lie around, think about books, not talk bad, to people who write. Yeah, I just loved it. And I thought, well, what job is there which allows you to do something like this? And they say, well, writing, you know, and I've been studying English literature. I like books already. Maybe that's something that I could do. And I think that was the inspiration for it. It was more a lifestyle thing. And then in terms of the modernism, I'd look around and go, well, do I want to be like Trollope and be a, you know, work for the post office and be a novelist? I think, well, not really. I want to be like those French writers. You know, I want to hang around the south bank of the Seine and go to jazz clubs. And therefore, you know, I want to be a modernist type writer. That's very inspiring. And I think France generally sort of inspired me as a way to be an artist. And, you know, black polar necks, shades. There's something I read once, which I always remember, which was in the 1954 census in France. There were 1 million people who answered the census who self-identified as intellectuals. And that's out of a population of about 40 million. And I thought, yeah, that's the kind of country I want to live in. And I was lucky enough to live in Paris later on. And the other thing about that time, after the war in the jazz clubs, they would let in people who looked interesting. And the way they could tell whether you looked interesting or not was basically if you were carrying a book, you could get into the jazz club for free. I mean, it then does sort of beg a question, well, what kind of book did it have to be? And then you get into all sorts of anxieties about what's cool, what's not cool in 1953 in the sixth arrondissement. But I mean, I thought that was a nice statement about the France that inspired me is that France. That I know there are lots of other versions of France, but it's that version of France that I wanted to be a part of. So if I could live like a student and a little bit like a French self-identified intellectual in Paris in about 1957, great.
I can entirely identify with that. I think I spent most of my late teens and early 20s on the tube whenever I was in London with a copy of La Nausée by Jean-Paul Sartre, just to make me look interesting on the Northern Line. I don't think it particularly worked. But when you first start writing, I don't want to belittle these books at all, because, I mean, they're fascinating precepts. But I read somewhere that it sort of comes from an Ulipo school, which I was not familiar with this particular school of writing until mugging up a little bit more on you. But kind of fascinating ways of structuring a book. So X20 is about somebody who's trying to give up smoking, who writes something down every time he has a cigarette. I think Damascus is probably not quite in the same vein, but about events that take place on the day the Maastricht Treaty is signed. And I'm particularly fascinated by The Cartoonist, in which you had to completely rewrite because of concerns about libel, which is supposedly set in Euro Disney, but not set in Euro Disney. Is that correct? Would that be fair to say? But all of these books seem to categorize kind of, I'm not going to say tricksy, but you've imposed on yourself something that's quite rigid, which I wonder, again, is that a little bit about control when you start the writing? If you force yourself down a relatively narrow path, that makes it easier, more controllable to do?
Yeah, well, let me tell you a little bit about the Ulipo, which is obviously French literary movement, although Italo Calvino was a major part of it, and Harry Matthews, an American, was a part of it. So mid-60s onwards, and it is the workshop for potential literature, if you translate it. But basically, it's about constraints. If you set yourself constraints, that will allow you to generate text. So on my second novel, Damascus, all the nouns, apart from 12 nouns in the novel, come from one edition of the Times newspaper. And the idea behind that was to write a novel of its times. So it's the 1st of November 1993, which is therefore the first British European novel. It's the first day after the Maastricht Treaty, when we all become European citizens. So I think there's a very sort of simple idea behind it. It's democratic in the sense that anyone else can take, you know, any other newspaper they like and write their own novel. When I started off, I thought I was going to use The Sun But then I discovered that just is not, the range of vocabulary is just not there to write a novel, which is why I ended up with The Times. But actually that worked better anyway, because it's a novel of its times. And, you know, I quite like the pun. But in terms of what we're talking about today, the Ulipo is relevant because the rules which the Ulipo set up, and they tried to make lists of different experiments and rules you could make, which were part of this workshop. So it's the Ouvroir de Littérature Potentielle, and the Ouvroir is a workshop. So it's about an artisan approach to writing. And it's a way of getting rid of a romantic idea of inspiration. It's not, you know, writing is not about wandering about and being struck in a field of daffodils by the inspiration which will allow you to write a poem or a book or whatever. They were very explicitly trying to get away from that romantic notion of inspiration. And they were inspired by mathematicians. And there are mathematicians in the Ulipo as well. And finding different ways to create text, which in a way they were trying to take the subjectivity out of it and create these forms which would both generate text and allow you to say, well, anyone else can use this as well. We can all share this, and anyone who wants to write can create a new text. I mean, the simple example of how it works really is that if someone gives you a blank piece of paper and says, write me a story, it's almost impossible. But if someone says to you, empty the contents of your useful drawer in your kitchen, now write me a story which involves at least seven of these objects, then it's a pretty much easier thing to do. You've generated the text by having a constraint. And the most famous Ulipian constraint is George Perec's La Disparition, where he doesn't use the letter E in the whole novel. And in a way, this kind of disproves the principle behind the Ulipo when they started, because it's supposed to be objective. He set himself this constraint. It's going to generate the text, because clearly he can't have I in French, but he can have he. He can't have she, but he can have they if they're masculine, and so on. So it's going to generate what actually happens in this text. But in fact, what Perec was doing was something much more interesting than that. Well, he did write this novel, which some reviewers didn't recognize that there was no E and just thought it was a bit odd. But he wrote this text, which was supposed to be objective, generated by these constraints. But then it turns out it's called La Disparition, which means the disappearance, so the disappearance of the letter E. But La Disparition is also the name on the Act de Disparition, the piece of paper which was signed to deport Jews during the Second World War from France. And his parents had been killed in the Holocaust. And what is missing in French from this text is the E, them. So the letter E is E, and it's also EUX. So what starts as a constraint then becomes a sort of deeply personal text about, I can get rid of a whole class of letter, just like in France in the early 40s, and get rid of a whole class of people, and people won't even notice. You know, you can read that and you won't even notice. And it's a beautifully elegant demonstration of both how the Ulipo can be deeply emotional and meaningful and elegant, but also it remains very personal. And that's what I would hope to have with my own constraints as well. The thing I've just finished is a memoir where I try and write 1,000 words for each year of my life, from age 0 to age 63. And I'm not yet 63, so there are some years in the future as well. But it's a very simple constraint. You know, and anyone can use that. And anyone can work out for themselves, well, how best can I do that? How can I sum up whole years in 1,000 words? It's not very much. But straight away, the generative process has started. It allows people to be creative. And the great thing about the Ulipo is it enables creation. And if anyone is stuck in their writing, I would recommend them have a look at the Ulipo. There's Penguin Book of the Ulipo. There's the Ulipo Compendium, which gives a lot of the structures that they invented, which, you know, are like games, really. Start playing with them, and you'll actually find out something deeply personal about yourself, which was not what they intended, but that is the end result.
You see, unfortunately, what you've just done is ruin my next question, which was not so much a question as an assertion, really, because I was going to go on to Acts of the Assassins and Lazarus is Dead, because Acts of the Assassin seems to me to be a book that is gloriously unconstrained. I mean, I suppose it has its genre, but it is an extraordinary genre, namely noir cop thriller set in ancient Rome, but with aeroplanes and guns and whatnot. And it's almost like you've gone, there are no constraints here. I can transport, I can put my main character, my gumshoe, who's trying to work out why all these people keep dying. They're essentially the apostles, are they not? It's a mystery. We're trying to find out who's killing them. But it's also a comedy in large part. I mean, genuinely hilarious sections in which very sort of modern police language is being used to talk about, you know, how someone's died. Almost like you get on Silent Witness to a degree. There's almost like pathology in there that we'd recognize from now. And it seems to me to be gloriously unconstrained. But I guess what you've just said to me is that Alippo is constrained in name only, that it's not actually a constraint. It's a freeing up mechanism.
I mean, by the time I got to Acts of the Assassins, that I had moved away from the Ulippo a bit. That was very much there at the beginning to apply to novels. And I've come back to it for memoir to find a new angle on memoir. But in between, there are a couple of other experiments. And Acts of the Assassins is essentially an experiment in genre and in time. And I did, I think, what a lot of people have done historically, which is a lot of writers have done historically, is when you're stuck for a subject, go back to the Bible. There's loads of great stories in there. And the first one of those Bible stories was Lazarus. And half of the book is what happens before he dies, and half of the book is what happens in the week after he comes back to life. But the Acts of the Assassins was, when I was researching Lazarus, I came across, you know, clearly the apostles were part of that story. They're quite jealous of Lazarus in my Lazarus version, because he is the only named friend. They're just disciples. He's a friend in the hierarchy of Jesus's contacts. I think friend is better. So I became aware of the apostles, and because of the martyrologies, which were written through, I suppose, 1,200 years, 1,400 years after Jesus was recorded as a historical figure, their deaths were increasingly exaggerated because they had to be martyrs to the cause and show how much they believed in the resurrection of Jesus, and by dying in these horrible ways, which they could endure because of their faith. And the more I looked at it, the more it looked like, you know, if you imagine the same person had done this to each of them, and, you know, Bartholomew skinned alive, you have, I can't remember which one now, but who's wrapped in papyrus, which is then doused in dolphin oil and set alight. You know, these are in the martyrology. This is how the apostles are. But I think, well, if one person had done this, this is the most crazed serial killer you could ever come across. Well, there's a genre there, serial killers, and you have a serial killer, you have a detective. And then I think, well, the Romans, you know, they've got this disappeared corpse. What do you do if you're detectives? You look for disappeared people, classic plot. But in terms of the time, that was really inspired by the religion. And, you know, the Bible is all time. It starts at the creation of the universe in the Old Testament and goes through to the end of the world in Revelation. So you could say, well, within that, all time is there. And I couldn't see any reason why in this story it wouldn't be interesting to have all time conflated around this one story. And Jesus is nothing if not timeless. And that seemed to fit. And I think technically it worked out in a very pleasing manner. Now, there's no reason why you shouldn't have Judas explaining what he's done to this sort of bevy of microphones on a table before him doing a press conference. And it just worked out in a way which I found very pleasing. I'm glad you liked it.
I'm going to take us full circle now, because I want to take us back to Sad Little Men before we finish off, and just suggest to you that in Acts of the Assassins, what you've done is almost purge yourself of all of the constraints and the routines and the absurd petty rules and the nonsenses that you were institutionalized in from the age of 8 to the age of 18. And you found a way of saying, of questioning absolutely everything in that book, and throwing them all up and saying, well, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. It could be pretty much anything you want it to be. Is that fair?
I think that's fair in the sense that my instinct to, or my, if you like, my inspiration to write things which are new and want to make them new does contain a rejection of the old. You know, inspiration can come from a kind of negative inspiration, the things you don't want to do. I don't want to repeat very familiar rules and regulations, because in the past, in a sort of non-fiction sense, those very traditional familiar rules and regulations have not been to my advantage. I mean, I haven't enjoyed them. I didn't like them. I don't feel they did me any good. And maybe psychologist Dan, yes, you've found something there to explain why I like modernist stuff.
I think that's where we're going to leave it. I heartily recommend that book and Lazarus is Dead and many of your books, actually. It's just that Acts of the Assassin somehow screams to me. I advise everybody listening to this to go and buy it. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds today.
Thanks, Dan. It's been a pleasure to be here.
You have been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Richard Beard. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.
The opinions expressed by guests on Rathbones Inspired Minds are personal and will not necessarily reflect the views of Rathbones Investment Management, nor will they constitute a recommendation or advice to buy or sell any product or service on behalf of Rathbones Group PLC.